I'll have to show you the checklist.
Yeah,
you would not be surprised to learn there's a checklist.
No, there's a checklist for the checklist. And then there's a checklist on that. It's checklists all the way down.
Yes.
Yeah. Dog, I heard you like checklists.
Yeah. Yo.
I love checklists. After not making it to 12 full episodes last year, we're now recording our second one in a month. So,
yes, efficiently. Yes. In the Trump administration. Yes.
The podcast will run on time.
Yes. The podcast will run on time. That's right. We are recording, what is it? Is it the 21st or the 22nd? It was the 22nd today, right?
It is indeed the 22nd, sir.
Two days into the Trump administration.
The world has not ended yet.
Yeah. Mattis is being confirmed. That's good and sworn in. He's one of the better picks.
He was a very good pick. I was a little surprised.
I'm a little alarmed that he may have been picked solely because his nickname is Mad Dog.
Yeah.
Well, that's fair. If I were going to pick a Secretary of Defense, and I know, as Donald Trump assuredly does, that the best defense is just a terrific offense.
Huge.
Then you're going to need a Mad Dog leading the charge. That's just how it's going to be.
Does he understand the nickname's ironic?
I'm sure not.
Okay.
I would really doubt that he understands that.
Does he know what irony means?
Probably. Or at least he can call his daughter and ask.
Yeah. Can we say that Trump's actually not stupid? Or, like, he's not the idiot he plays on TV?
Oh, yeah. He's nowhere near the idiot he plays on TV.
Yeah.
He's smart enough that even in a very challenging business environment, he finds just spectacularly unethical ways to keep his business afloat.
Yeah.
I mean, he has a certain level of cunning that you have to appreciate, regardless of his general incoherence or his lack of interest in facts or any of the other things that we can point out as his foibles.
While we often lament him as having won a race to the bottom, in fairness, he ran that race well.
Yeah,
he did.
He knew right where he was going.
Yes.
He was like, move. Yep.
They go high, we go low, we'll go lower.
Yeah. You know, because, like, the moment where I realized that Trump has some lucidity is whenever the congressional Republicans decide, hey, it's our first day back. What should we do? Let's gut this ethics committee. And, you know, Trump said, guys, leave the stupidity to me.
He actually said that?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
But
that would have sold me on your case. That would
be, he did, in fact, say it was bad timing.
Yeah.
And then proceeded to do other stupid things. Yeah. So, you know.
My theory that I'm working off of, and there's been, like, I've been listening. I listened to part of a Ricochet podcast with Victor Davis Hanson.
Oh, yeah.
Where he says that Trump plays crazy in order to get a middle ground. He's doing, like, this crazy negotiating tactic constantly.
Right. He's setting the baseline so far out that people are willing to negotiate for something much closer to what he wants than they would otherwise be willing to concede.
That's a tactic that I've used, and I really hope that I don't come across as badly as Trump does.
Well,
let's go ask.
Simon, I think Trump has acquired a level of misogyny and general disregard for women that is far beyond anything you will accomplish in your lifetime, sir.
I certainly hope so.
I mean, it's ingenious. I absolutely hate it, but it's ingenious because it's this whole signal to noise ratio, right? Like, if what we just have going on, we have the press secretary come out and yell at the press pool for talking about the fact that they had less people at the inauguration. It's stupidity. It's absolute stupidity. But if they do that and the press is eating all that up, Trump can sign whatever he wants.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. He's been doing that before he was president, where he would distract from whatever real scandal he was involved in by creating a Twitter feud.
Mm-hmm. You say ingenious, I say horrifying. No, same thing, I suppose.
It is. I even if we get, even if I get stuff that I would like, I don't want to get it this way.
Right.
Yeah.
It's rather like winning a case with Anthony Kennedy's vote. I mean, you're happy for the win, but at the same time, it just feels icky.
Well, you know, I know it's like we're going to get this, but we're also going to get tariffs and a trade war with China, and we're going to bring back old school nepotism, you know.
I'm not sure the nepotism was so old school, but it will be more flagrant and more flamboyant.
Yeah, very flagrant.
I think this is the difference between, you asked last time about the Clintons and whether the corruption will be worse with Trump. My answer is, was and is, yes, but yeah, more flagrant is particularly what I have in mind. Less shameless. More shameless?
More shameless.
More shameless,
yeah.
Yeah. It'll be the best shamelessness.
Should we talk about our beer?
Let's talk about our Belgian friends.
Yes.
And toast to them with our very fine beer.
Are we going to toast to Belgium? Really?
Yes.
Okay. To Belgium.
To Belgium. You guys matter.
To Belgium. Yes, Mike and I are drinking a Belgian beer, a southern Belgian beer, Walloon, from the Chimay Trappist monks at Scouermont Abbey Hino, I believe that's correct, and it's rather good. I'm very much enjoying it.
It is good. They make good beer, besides not actually existing.
I can just see how contrite you are. We'll get to that. We'll get to that, but Sam is drinking something different, so go ahead.
That humble pie is sitting over here, untouched by the hands of Mike.
Are you suggesting that there's going to be a pie fight in a minute? So, Sam, what are you drinking?
Well, I got you all the very fine Belgian beer, which, by the way, was accidental.
Oh, really?
I got this...
You meant to go to France?
No. I got this before the whole Belgian connection was made. So it was a really fascinating coincidence, but I'm drinking a Bell's Expedition Stout, which is a very good Russian Imperial Stout, and actually I should probably look. What is the alcohol content of this?
This is going to be an interesting podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
10.5% apparently.
Now, did you eat 30 minutes before the podcast?
I did, actually.
Okay, so we should be okay.
Yes, I had a very lovely salad and some hummus.
Yeah.
Which probably counts even less, according to you, Simon.
Yes.
Rabbit food. Yeah, I hate to report this, chaps, but this is 8% too, so this could turn into an interesting podcast.
Yeah.
Okay, so, Mike, the listeners are not happy with you.
Yes, apparently I have upset a nation, which means that I should be getting a call from Fox News any day now. I'm looking forward to that.
Okay.
You know, if Trump wants to make me ambassador to Belgium, you know, there's worse places to be.
That sounds like his style, but I'm wondering what is going to be the name of your show?
I'm right. Mike's right.
Okay.
Actually seems appropriate.
Yeah, there's at least like a segment called Mike's Right. Yeah.
Okay.
This really grinds my gears.
Yeah.
So the gravamen of your complaint, of your case against Belgium, is that it's a synthetic country comprising two ethnic groups who you say hate each other, the Flemish and the Walloon. And there are several objections that have been raised to this. And I should point out that just from my own reading, it does seem to be fair that whether it is synthetic or not, it is the same age as the United States. It's been a polity as either as part of the United Kingdom of the Netherlands or Belgium itself, and it kind of gets fuzzy between there was a revolution in 1790 and then between there and 1815. I'm a little unclear. I've read a lot about Belgium in the last 2 days.
Yeah.
But, you know, so to be fair, if it is a synthesized nation, it's just as old as ours, right?
But we're a nation that was made up of one cultural tradition. And we have...
But the reason that Belgium separated, I found this fascinating. One of the reasons why Belgium separated from the Netherlands was that there was a Catholic minority in what is now Belgium that was hostile to the, mutually culturally incompatible with the Protestant North in what is now the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And so if the country begins as a culturally unified thing that just happens to have a language divide.
But right? It doesn't have a, like, the group that ends up politically in control of the area is one group, but then as the state emerges, you have the language divide, but it's not just a language divide, it's a cultural divide. Belgium isn't a fully Catholic country.
Well, not you now. Know. I suspect, like most of Europe, it's quite thoroughly secular.
Well, I mean, just in terms of culturally, because you can still talk about non-practicing people, and they'll be really, really excited about being Catholic or Protestant, even though they haven't stepped in a church in decades. But, you know, it's just one of these places that, you know, they drew a line, and there's different cultural groups in there, and there doesn't seem to be that sense of unity. That sense of Belgium-ness.
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, I watched the lovely video provided by our Belgian friends, yeah. And I found that there is some sort of unifying principle to the Belgian experience, which is a horrifyingly Byzantine government structure. I thought the United States structure with all of its layers and its many facets was pretty complex and pretty ridiculous in some ways, and then I saw the structure of Belgian government.
Let me make
and perhaps they've won, you know, they they beat us.
Yes. Well, let me used this metaphor to go the other way when we were talking earlier, but maybe I should use the metaphor to argue in Belgium's defense.
England, always in Belgium's defense.
A lot of this is rhetorical, you know. I'm just trying to spur some interesting conversation. So, if you think of the three of us as American Catholics, we are subject to federal and state governments. Local governments functionally are part of the state, but we are also subject to at least one diocese. If one was a member of the Anglican Ordinariate, one might be subject to two archbishops, each of which, I mean, the Catholic Church has a serious legal code, a legal system, Mike, you've had encounters with it. Mm-hmm. It's a for real legal system, and it's just as infuriating and Byzantine as the real one, or the secular one, I should say. So, is that not comparable to the Belgian thing where you have the feds, the smaller level, and then the quirk, as I watched that video, was the communities, the jurisdiction that depends on what language you speak, rather than physically where you are, which seems very much to me like a personal prelature. So is it so Byzantine, depending on how powers are split up? I don't know.
Yes.
Okay. Simple, clean answer. I admire that brevity.
As an American, I can choose whether or not, to submit myself to the authority of the Catholic Church's judicial system. And it has no relevance in secular state terms. But in Belgium, they have you have a governmental system that's designed to encourage and segregate different cultural aspects. It'd be like all of the Hispanics were under the authority or received benefits from an American Hispanic Federation, and all the African Americans, the African American Federation, and so on and so forth. You know, it seems the antithesis of building a national character.
It was exhorted on me that segregation is certainly not the intention, but I kind of take your point that this is a slightly harder separation. I mean, my question was, there's a Guardian article that says that there's not an awful lot of social intercourse between the two parts. Mm-hmm. They said, well, there's probably not, you don't have a lot of social intercourse with people in St. Louis either. Well, that's probably true. That's a fair point. I suppose that the counter argument is that it's not even a counter argument, but it feels like when there is a hard linguistic barrier, which, by the way, something else interesting. The Flemish, or the North, apparently, are required to learn French, mm-hmm. but the Walloon are not required to learn Dutch. Mm-hmm. They can choose to learn English instead, and because of the nature of the world economy, they tend to do so. And so you kind of have this kind of enforced monolingualism in these two halves, but one half is capable of, you know, or theoretically, I mean, you know, I was required to learn French in school, but I don't think I could survive being airdropped in France. So.
Yeah, because I'll grant, you know, Belgium is quite obviously a state, but I would submit that it is not a nation.
A couple of the points that they came back with was, you know, first to underscore that Flemish and Walloons don't personally have any friction with one another. That, you know, that just because there's a political division doesn't necessarily mean that there's any kind of social division. And that also feels intuitively correct, right? I mean, you know,
good fences make good neighbors. Is that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, you know, people in Indianapolis may hate the Chicago Bears, but they don't hate people from Chicago, unless they happen to play for the Bears, in which case, sure. But you know, we live fairly close to the Indiana-Illinois border. It is a very normal thing to go back and forth. My grandkids spent half of their lives in Illinois at this point, with their Illinoisian family. You know, this is just a foreign thought. You know, even though in many senses the American states have a much harder sovereignty than I'm supposing that these two sections of Belgium do, you know, there's no personal animosity between people in different states, with the caveat that we'll come back to with regard to political alignment. I want to put a pin in that because I think that's something that's worth coming back to.
So, Belgium is, in terms of geography, about the size of Maryland.
Okay.
Could you imagine two halves of Maryland that don't congregate at all? Like, we're not just talking about, we're not talking about social economic, we're talking about geographic and cultural reasons. This isn't Republicans and Democrats. You know, to say this is political, that's just like scratching one surface. We're talking about two ethnic and geographic areas.
Well, suppose, try this for a hypothetical. Suppose there were the southernmost county in Texas was a bit of a reach when Texas stole it from Mexico. I mean, the Great Revolution arrived.
Do I need to get my cowboy hat?
Yes.
Is this that moment?
Right.
I was born in Texas too.
Okay.
You know.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
So the southernmost county in Texas is geographically cut off from the rest of Texas by an Anna branch that comes off of the Rio Grande, and there's plenty of long established bridges. It's basically a creek, right? It's not a major thing, but almost the entire population of that county speaks Spanish. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, a large enough community that it's basically self-sustaining in terms of jobs and things like that. Would we think it odd that they don't really go over the river that often? Would that somehow fatally divide the great state of Texas?
The great state of Texas is divided, but yeah. You know, I guess if they're not crossing, if there's a hard divide between the people who are on the river and the people who are on the other side of the river, then I'd say, yeah, those two people are two separate cultures, you know. But there's a difference between, like, that and Austin. But
another point that was raised was that being Belgian as an identity does mean something. People from Holland are louder and more outspoken. People from France are less modest. This isn't me talking, French friends. People from Germany don't share our self-scathing sense of humor, which is why I like the Belgians. They're very much the Canadians of Europe, if you want. That's not me.
Uh-huh.
That's,
uh-huh. Yeah.
Right. But we like Canadians, right? But
sorry.
But Is it not possible to have an identity that transcends ethnicity? Is there not a Latin Rite Catholic identity that transcends national borders?
Of course there is.
There was, I suppose. We can't say there is now, but...
Of course it's possible to have an identity that transcends ethnicity. Like, in the United States, as Americans, mm-hmm. we have an identity that transcends ethnicity.
Now, this is where I'm going next, but I'll continue the thought.
But I would argue that their system is set up in such a way to be the antithesis of that. They have, even if the, you know, now granted, I don't know people from Belgium, so I'm speaking from complete ignorance, so maybe I'm a giant jackass, and I'm sorry, Belgium.
But, there's an episode title. I'm a giant jackass, and I'm sorry, Belgium.
Yeah. But it's in terms of how it's shaped, it just fosters these separate ethnic and cultural areas. It doesn't lend itself to
assimilation.
Yeah, it doesn't.
There's no integrated national culture.
Yeah, I mean, from the video, the fact that was it the prime minister or president of Belgium?
Prime minister, that's right.
Yeah, the prime minister of Belgium, whenever he was asked to sing the Belgian national anthem, he sings the French national anthem. That just shows.
To further that case, the politics of it seem just uniquely divided. So, you know, and also the media, obviously, because there's a language divide, so there's no national newspaper. But then you could say that about the United States. But at any rate, there are no national political parties either. My question was, if you have three official languages, what language is are statutes drafted in? Because languages are not perfectly cognate with one another, and the answer is all three.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, apparently it works, but they must have a very different enterprise of, you know, how judges do law than we would. So
yeah, I'm wondering what happens here in the U.S. when English and Spanish are both official languages.
I would take Spanish as the official language before I would take bilingualism. I think that at least as a working language for Congress,
mm-hmm.
Because there has to be one, or at least for textualists, right? This is just a Texas perspective, but if law is the words, is the semantic content of the text, you can't have bilingualism. And I assume that if we look closely at Canada, we'll find that their judicial enterprise is very different from ours. Because that, you know, what do you do when you have two different, when you have a text that's in two different languages, the meaning of a case turns on the precise meaning of this one term, and it's different in Spanish than it is in English.
Yeah, which is quite possible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm certain that happens in Canada.
To be fair, I should be clear. There are other cases you can imagine in which that's helpful, right? Because the term is ambiguous in English but clear in Spanish. But I think that just looking at the history of the legal system, I suspect that will lead to that's the stuff of nightmares. So yeah, I would happily take Spanish before I would take bilingualism.
I mean, the one advantage in the United States is that we don't have an official language.
Right.
That's true. I'm just not sure how long that's going to last.
Maybe it should be Latin.
There we
All
go.
Laws shall be drafted in Latin. I want to ask about the United States because I want to put this in a more provocative form. We started from you suggesting like that Belgium is a made-up country comprising two ethnic groups who hate each other.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it fair to level the same question at the United States at this point? My social media feeds, I have a lot of friends on both sides, and so they're usually quite schizophrenic. But the last, I would say, 72 hours have been even more schizophrenic than usual, to the point where it is very, very strange looking at the things that people are saying. Isn't it fair to say that today we're a synthetic country with two different nations who hate each other with different cultures, values, and speak mutually incomprehensible dialects of English?
Well, we have different cultures within the United States. We have a whole bunch of people who hate each other. But because the blocks transcend geographic areas, because the blocks transcend cultural areas. You know, it's mainly white people hating white people. You know.
But that's starting to, not on the race piece, but on the geography piece. Yeah. That is starting to change.
Starting as people vote with their feet. Yeah.
We should pause to note the most spectacular piece of data visualization I've seen in years of the election. The election as geography piece. You see mm-hmm. the Trump upland and the Clinton archipelago. That was a spectacular. I'll put that in the show notes. That was a spectacular piece mm-hmm. of work. Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. So, you know, I'd say that the United States does have, we still do have a common culture. Like, you know, anyone who travels abroad, you ask people who are from elsewhere, they can identify an American just like that. It doesn't matter where they're from. And
we're the ones who are fat and lazy.
Well, we're the ones who are loud. We're the ones who are generally optimistic. We're the ones who talk a lot. We're the ones who invent. We're the ones who, you know, go out and do stuff. You know, it's some of the stereotypes are not actually all negative. It does.
Yeah, what? We're the ones who went to the moon.
Yeah, we're the ones who went to the moon. That is true. That is true. Eat it, Russia. Yeah.
Although maybe that's worth, you know, the elephant in the room here is the fact that I can say we're the ones who went to the moon as someone who's an immigrant, as someone mm-hmm. who's not mm-hmm. born here. But one can become an American. Yeah. I mean, we've talked about this before, in a way that one can become a citizen of France, but one will never be French.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, And so I'd say there is something, like there definitely is an American nation, an American character. You could argue that it's synthetic, and I'd actually be inclined to agree with that. You know, we're something that we did not evolve organically in the same way that England did or France did.
I mean, the way that Justice Scalia put it was that it was the America was bound by shared fidelity to certain political principles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that's now fraying, isn't it? We're
yes.
becoming more of
yeah.
an ethnic nation.
As things start to fray in terms of political identity and as we devalue assimilation and devalue integration, it's becoming more and more of an issue. You know, one of my biggest fears is, you know, just as Belgium has these institutionalized blocks promoting different ethnic groups, I'm afraid that we would have that, and that's going to solidify, you know, disunity.
That seems much less likely now than it did a couple of months ago, because, you know, Trump is a huge stone that's thrown in the pond, and where the ripples go, no one quite knows. But one thing that is clear is that he will essentially be able to do whatever he wants for the next 2 years,
mm-hmm.
Maybe 4 years, depending on, you know, the math is very difficult for the Democrats in 2018. So, you know, he kind of has a free rein to kind of remake the landscape as he sees fit. Does that change that calculus at all?
Well, I mean, Trump was elected on the back of white working class America embracing what they rejected. You know, Trump was identity politics. Trump was elected on the back of white working class identity politics. And whether or not he's going to play to that, he seems to be really, really stepping away from that and trying to invoke a new nationalism. You know, everyone who's America is, you know, we're all Americans, and as long as, you know, you're Americans and you're patriotic, then you're great in my book.
I think it was summed up well in the inauguration speech.
Mm-hmm.
Where it was said, and I'm sure that Donald Trump did not write this line, that if you open your heart to patriotism, there is no room for prejudice.
Yeah.
And to me, that was sort of emblematic of the whole Trump enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds good. It's appealing. We want to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's false.
Mm-hmm.
And we know it's false.
Yeah.
There have been lots of very patriotic people in America who have been incredibly prejudiced.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Jackson, patriot all the way. You can't fault him for not being a patriot. But was he prejudiced? Was he genocidal? Yes.
Yeah, I suppose that's
He started it.
Yeah.
Interesting. Van Buren was the one who finished it. Van Buren actually enforced that. Historical footnote for today.
I didn't like Van Buren anyway.
Yeah.
Do we have more we want to talk about on Belgium?
Let's move on.
Okay.
I think we've beat up on Belgium
enough. Okay.
I believe you mean you've beat up on Belgium enough.
Oh, everyone's stepping back. I'm going to get, like, some Belgian terrorist is going to put mayo in my fries.
You never know.
They could
poison your chocolates.
Yeah, they could poison my chocolates. Or worse yet, not sell me beer. Please don't not sell me beer. I like your beer.
The Underground Railroad for beer. Like,
I'll go to a beer. There's going to be signs of me up. Don't sell beer to this man. Yeah.
Yeah, but it'll be in French.
It'll be in French and Dutch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, before we get into other stuff where we'll lose them, my Belgian friends are Battlestar fans, and there's a question I've been wanting to run past you, Sam, as our in-house ethicist for a while, but it does require a little bit of brief introduction, and maybe this will get cut. I'll have you guys know, I cut a lot of myself out of the last episodes. Like, most of the things that were cut were me, so... Yeah.
Huh.
I told my Apple story, and you know what? I listened to it after, it's like, no, this is boring. This is gone. This is gone. Because you know what? The podcast comes first.
There
the
you go.
The integrity of the entertainment of the podcast comes first. It's not about me.
Noblesse oblige.
That's right. So here is the ethical conundrum. In the universe of Battlestar Galactica, the real one, not the 1970s one, the main adversary is a race called the Cylons, who start out as machines and become and take
really
organic
hot.
Form.
They become really hot.
They become really hot, yeah. Organic machines. That's right.
Yeah.
Dean Stockwell, as I've said before on the podcast,
fantastic.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, when Stockwell wore that red dress, yeah, bam. Anyway, they don't reproduce biologically. They transfer their consciousness from one host body, if you like, into another one. There are two episodes of the show in which plans are proposed that will destroy the entire race. And in one, the show is quite heavy-handed at hinting that this was the decision to do it is wrong, that it's ethically unacceptable. In one of them, the idea is that we'll introduce a virus that will somehow transfer with an infected host back to the resurrection ship. And thence spread to the entire population. And we don't need to spoil whether they actually do it, but the argument that's made against it, which to me seems obviously correct, is that that's genocide. It's a crime against humanity to infect people with a virus when doing so will wipe out an entire species. It's not even an entire nation. You know, gens, Latin for nation. You know, it's an entire species. But then later on, the proposal is made to destroy the means by which they do this transfer. And so everyone who is currently living is eventually going to reach the age of their body's, you know, lifespan and die. It seems to me that the same end result obtains in either case, right? All of them die. So why is there a different moral valence to the one than the other? Is it just a bit about time?
I think it is about time, but not because it's time. Hmm. I think it's about time because time means we get to live more fully. Time means that we have the opportunity to make more choices. Time means that we get more opportunities to change ourselves and grow. I mean, time isn't just time. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it was just the kind of ticking of the decay of a cesium atom, then that would be fairly irrelevant ethically. But in terms of the richness that you get with that time and your life, it's a lot more significant.
Well, let me put it in a rather fanciful but concrete human example. If President Trump pushes the button and kills all human life on Earth, the descendants of the people up on the space station, when they come back down, a la the 100... right, are going to form a judgment about that action. But suppose Dr. Doom out there in Latveria concocts a chemical castrative and introduces it into the water supply surreptitiously. And once it has reached 100% penetration into the population, right, he announces that this has been done. The human race is done. Right. This seems the same thing, right? You know, in both cases, you have killed all human. The human race is now, you know, either extinct or in The Walking Dead. Is this not? These just seem like different things.
They are different things. I mean, ethics is never just about results. Ethics is always about intentions. It's about, you know, proximate causes. There are a lot more factors to ethical thinking than simply what is the end result and is it the same as this other scenario? I mean, at least, you know, at least in most ethical systems. You know, maybe if you have some weird form of utilitarianism where the only thing that counts is at the end of time what the ultimate outcome is, maybe those would look ethically equivalent, but in no other system would that be the case.
I'd just say that, you know, given the case of Battlestar Galactica, it makes sense. You have a group of people, you know, the humans are running, they're fleeing. You have a group of people, the Cylons, who are intent on destroying the humans.
But they're really hot, Mike.
They are really hot. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so...
That Callum Keith Rennie.
And...
if you don't
see,
take out...
My frustration here is just that I can't tell you which Cylon I'm actually attracted to, because she's one of the final five. I've said too much already.
So... if you don't take out their regeneration ships, the issue is they have an almost infinite supply.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, perhaps if we, you know, taking out the regeneration ships, maybe they can find a different way to more slowly populate.
The sporting chance doctrine.
Yeah,
like.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly.
It's the season 4 storyline where they take out the hub that...
Yeah.
I didn't get that same sense of moral conflict watching them do that in season 2. That I did in season 4.
Mm-hmm.
Spoilers for all of the show, but the idea is that when we first meet the concept of how this works, it's presented that this is a ship that they download to.
Mm-hmm.
And so the implication is that taking it out, they essentially lose the capacity to do that. And then later on, they kind of recycle that storyline by suggesting, well, okay, now there is a hub that ties all of these ships together. And it just feels really different. You know, there's a real certain ambiguity about it by the time we get to it in season 4. And I don't know if that's just because the storytelling by that point has humanized the enemy. You really do get, you know, a real sense of Stockholm syndrome watching season 3.
Mm-hmm.
When you start to see it from their perspective, it's like, oh, okay, yeah. And, you know, kind of humans, particularly once you start watching Capricorn, you realize people are dicks. Right, you know, people. You know, there's a real moral obtuseness in that's implicit in the backstory from Caprica about how humanity treats these. And when you get to the end of Caprica, there's lines that it's like, which side is the right side again? I'm not sure. That was done really well.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about Rogue One later, but one of the things I thought Rogue One didn't do well, but that Caprica did really well, was giving you a sense of who's the good guys again?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were trying to do that in Rogue One, though.
Yeah,
but it didn't really work for me. But anyway, but that's a whole other thing. But yay, Battlestar talk. We can't talk a whole lot about that because Sam still hasn't seen it. But we can.
I mean, you
that.
Can talk about it all you like. I don't care.
He's just going to sit there and listen. Yeah.
Okay. Speaking of intentions, you mentioned that. I want to raise something else. And I'm going to be a little vague on the details of this story because I don't remember them and they don't really matter that much. But the gravamen was that the FBI, I believe, sought a warrant to wiretap the Trump campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Or possibly it was the CIA. You know, something in the national security apparatus.
It would have been the FBI.
Right.
FBI handles counterterrorism.
Right, but this isn't counterterrorism.
Or
this
counterintelligence. Domestic counterintelligence is FBI.
Yeah, what we need is just like one unified.
Yes, let's bring it all together.
For efficiency.
Yes.
For efficiency.
Yes.
But we'll just call it the Panopticon, and it'll be great.
We could. It could be run by perhaps a committee for maybe state security.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe if we put a giant eye on the top of the Washington monument. I think that would be great.
You mean the Trump monument, the one that's painted gold?
Yeah. Can we call it the Politburo?
Yeah.
But anyway, so it's on a warrant for members of the Trump campaign because it was concerned that they might actually be colluding with Russia, mm-hmm. and it made me think back to Watergate. It made me think, well, what would we have thought if the Nixon administration, not the White House probably, but probably the CIA or the FBI, had gone up the chain of command and said, look, we are really concerned that there is collusion going on between the Democratic National Committee and the Soviet Union, which historically is not an absurd idea. I mean, Ted Kennedy wrote to Brezhnev, at least the ones that we know of. There are all kinds of examples of this where senior players in the Democratic Party had some level of contact with the Soviet Union. The KGB had the whole shooting match, infiltrated. And yet they are the political opponents. What are you to do if you are the president and you are running in a political campaign, which functionally Barack Obama was, against this organization that you legitimately think may actually be doing something wrong? What you're going to be kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't, right?
Yeah, you're in a James Comey situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, where it doesn't really matter what you do. It's going to look like you're the asshole who is taking political advantage.
Well, isn't the James Comey position that you then do both and have everyone hate
Yes.
That's the Comey maneuver.
Yeah, the Comey maneuver was definitely to err on both sides.
Yeah.
Piss off everyone on one side, then flip-flop and piss off everyone else on the other side.
Yes, that is exactly what he did.
Well, if you're doing it correctly, it shouldn't matter. If it's because, strictly speaking, it's these federal prosecutors who are applying for these warrants. A federal prosecutor applies for the warrants. The federal prosecutor should be independent, at least strictly speaking. It's not like the federal prosecutor has to get an okay from the White House.
Well, there are wrinkles to that, but certainly the FISA court is notionally independent. So even if the federal prosecutor isn't, even if he takes it to his boss and his boss takes it to his boss and his boss takes it to his boss, the president, and the president says, yeah, you better go get a warrant, boys, then at least you have that check. So it is a little different. I mean, I'm not pinch-hitting for Nixon, right? There was nothing legitimate about hiring Jim McCord to go and, break into the Watergate, but...
I mean, if you actually think that the opposition who is running for the highest office in the land is colluding with foreign agents, then yes, you have to do something about that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't blame them at all.
No, I don't either. I think the Obama administration was right to pursue that lead.
Well, what's interesting is what initially happened. So initially federal prosecutors, because Andrew McCarthy talks about this, federal prosecutors tried to get a criminal warrant, and that criminal warrant was turned down. And so then they went to FISA and got a FISA warrant. And he's saying that's really shady. There's a whole lot of smoke and there's fire somewhere.
Yeah, even if the fire is just kind of creeping up Trump's pants, it's there.
Are you suggesting liar, liar, pants on fire kind of situation?
Or? No, I'm just kind of saying it.
Okay.
It's not suggesting. Just throwing it out there. Not implying, not passive aggressively suggesting, just saying it.
Speaking of our glorious future, I have an item labeled, do you want Skynet? Because that's how you get Skynet.
Yeah, so this came up because I stumbled across an article from MIT's publication, actually, about a Google project to have machine learning tools finding the best way to design other machine learning tools. And while, to be clear, there are certainly limits to this particular project, it's not as if we're on the road to Skynet at this exact moment. We have
on the on ramp.
Right, we have nonetheless taken a look at the highway to Skynet and said, "Boy, we should really walk up to that highway. That looks like a good destination." So that was kind of a fascinating thing. One of the things that's really worrying about artificial intelligence is not that it's intelligent, but that it will be perpetually self-improving in terms of refining its own intelligence in a way that we simply can't match on our pitiful evolutionary timescales. And so this was a really fascinating development for me, because this is the first step toward having self-improving artificial intelligence of that kind, that could either, you know, leave us in the dust and go out in the universe and do its own thing, or could step on us on the way out.
I said Grey Goo is the pessimistic scenario and Her is the optimistic scenario, where at the end the artificial intelligence... Yeah, I did not find it terribly comforting that the principal limitation on this at the moment is just sheer computing power. That doesn't seem like it's a limitation that I'd want to bank on.
that really doesn't. Moore's Law has been less predictive lately. We haven't been getting quite the same rate of return on our investments in additional computing power.
Makes sense.
But the investments we've made in quantum computing may ramp that back up very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Particularly at the high end where these kinds of projects live.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, we're not talking about desktop level stuff, probably. I mean, maybe.
Right, and here's the thing. Well, while it's true that I don't know of any immediate way that we could combine quantum computing with neural nets in some sort of perfectly integrated way, it is entirely possible that we could give a very advanced neural net access to quantum computers for its computing needs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is entirely possible.
Mm-hmm.
That is not without the realm of possibility currently.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen more and more disconnection, or perhaps I should say disaggregation of computer systems with virtualization and SANs and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So disconnecting the components so you can have storage over here and the brains, as it were, over here. It doesn't seem like an enormous leap to suppose, well, we can find different ways to... it's not uncommon at all now to have a separate GPU that is handling a subset of the tasks. And so, yeah, you can have a neural net that is hooked up to a more advanced computer that just handles a bit of the load. I don't see that as
unpredictable
at all.
Just the simplistic computational load.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you have a sufficiently powerful quantum computer that's stable, it can handle an immense computational load.
I'm thinking now of the IBM computer. Did you guys see Hidden Figures yet, that movie?
I haven't really watched any movies.
It's about principally three women at NASA in the 1960s. But one of
who did the math that saved lives?
Yeah, basically.
Fair enough.
One of them, I think at the start of the movie they are all of them computers, right? They this was the job title, and one of them is astute enough to realize that as soon as the behemoth IBM machine that has been brought in is actually up and working, they're going to be obsolete, so they better learn how to operate it and be the best operators of this IBM.
That's right.
I remember they specified what the number of operations per second was on this IBM. It was so pitiful. But now, as I suspect that we'll look back in a few years at the that my iPhone can do and say that was so pathetic. That was just nothing. It's not very far away.
No, it's not, and I think a number of AI experts who rightly say we're not there yet, we don't have this kind of encapsulated AI that can just kind of do all things.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not even close to that. They're right. I mean, that's true. We don't have anything close to that. We just have so many of the parts and we have ways to integrate those parts. That's why I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. It's because at some point we're going to decide, boy, we don't have a way to, you know, kind of encapsulate all this stuff into one form, but we can find integrations for all this stuff and make something like a Skynet. I'm really hoping that we call it Skynet.
Yeah.
You know, just you
know, someone's going to be really clever. They're going to be like, this is so funny. Ha ha ha.
Yeah.
Oh.
I guarantee this is exactly what will happen. This is because the same reason that people keep calling ships Prometheus. Right? Mm-hmm. If, you know what? If you call a ship Prometheus, you deserve everything that happens to you. You know what? Yeah, I can totally see that. It will and you know what? It'll be because it'll happen in America. It'll have some kind of ugly backronym. It'll stand for something, or it'll be like SKYNET, and they'll all be like, "Tee, we're really clever." That's my Boffin voice. "Tee, we're really clever."
Yeah.
I don't know why Boffin's a Pillsbury Doughboy in my head.
Or anywhere else, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, I for one will welcome our new robot overlords, but mm-hmm. I don't think other people will be so pleased.
That depends if the robot overlords look like Trisha Helfer or if they look like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Probably neither.
Yeah.
What if they look like C-3PO?
What are they gonna do, annoy us to death?
Yeah, I mean, an army of gay robots. Great.
Droid marriage equality.
Yes.
Yes, that's true. It would be important. Well, yeah, I'm actually already seeing that. People advocating for equal rights for artificial intelligence. That's mm-hmm. already happening. Yeah.
See, the challenge there is that it's so premature because we don't know what form it's going to take. I mean, there's kind of an assumption about what artificial intelligence would look like, just as there's assumptions about what it would look like when instantiated as robots. But I mean, is it conceivable that there are forms of artificial intelligence that do not proceed along the lines of, let's say, the HAL 9000, for sake of argument?
Actually, it's likely that they won't proceed along those lines.
What would you envisage as an alternative to that kind of... The science fiction model is always as a kind of a natural language interface that talks back.
Well, I suspect that would be a tiny... tiny subset of the functions a genuinely profound artificial intelligence would have. I mean, would a really good artificial intelligence be able to talk to us? Sure, that would be like a little doggy trick for their artificial intelligence. That would be nothing. So the kinds of thing we would be looking at would be the kinds of things we don't understand. You know, we would be watching an artificial intelligence manufacture things and have no clue what it was doing. Mm. We wouldn't even, in principle, have any idea what it was building, at least until it sucked all of the life out of our planet. You know, that's the kind of... And it probably wouldn't even mean us any harm when it did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, we would be the ants under the boot.
Right. Spoilers for The Expanse, but this is kind of the idea. Let's see, spoilers for book one, season one, parts of book two, and I'm guessing most of season two of The Expanse. The proto-molecule is essentially a device that is shot out to different solar systems. And it has a fairly straightforward set of instructions. Go to solar system A and build a kind of a gateway back to the home system out of whatever organic material you can get hold of. What could go wrong?
Yeah.
Right? So it looks like a really horrifying bioweapon, but its instruction set is actually fairly simple. It's just there to build a gate. Mm. Right? You know, it's a construction crew a la The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. By the way, gosh darn it, I totally forgot to mention. In The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Belgium is noted to be the most vile swear word in the galaxy.
Yes.
I just wanted to make sure that we mentioned that.
And if I recall, Cricket had a similar place.
I don't remember that one, but okay.
That was pretty fantastic.
Yeah, so it doesn't even have to be malicious.
No, in fact, it probably won't be. I mean, if an AI destroys us, it probably won't be because it has, you know, malevolent psychological motives. That's very unlikely. Well, yeah, it would be unlikely to perceive us as a threat, unless it's thinking about a sufficiently long timeline in which, you know, we on our pitiful evolutionary timescales eventually get to a point where we might threaten it.
Well,
and then it might say, well, let me do some opportunity cost calculations. Stomp.
Well, by that logic, it will also start constructing a device to snuff out the sun. Right, because over a sufficiently long time span, the sun will also snuff it out if it can't leave the planet.
It'll leave the planet.
Well, it'll be able to calculate that it's going to leave the planet well before that happens.
Well, but why bother? Right, you know, if it's going to be, as you say, a question of cost benefit.
Because it still needs energy.
Well,
solar collectors are pretty cheap energy. Yeah. Presuming that it has access to the solar collection technology that we.
Right,
are developing
then,
now.
Okay, so it's going to leave the planet and what, go to Mars, where the solar forcing is way lower?
Oh, you're thinking low here. You need to aim high.
It's going to build
But the further out you go, this is what I'm saying, the lower the solar yield.
It could build a...
Dyson sphere.
That's what it will do. It'll build a Dyson sphere, and it'll hold on that. And while it's building Dyson spheres, it's building probe ships to send out clones of itself to nearby star systems.
Maybe it could be building, like, say, giant shadow squares that could produce, like, say, Tabby's star?
Yeah, something like that, exactly.
Like a cross between Ringworld and Tabby's star?
Exactly.
Ooh, I'm liking this. Score one for AI. We just link back to Tabby's star.
Yes,
it's like the classic episode.
Yeah. Did I update about Tabby's
star? No, what's happening with Tabby's star?
So the latest update on Tabby's star is out of Columbia, they have a theory that what's caused it was actually collisions with a planetary body. They think what happened was either a planet or a planet and a whole bunch of moons just fell into the star.
Sure, an orbiting body as they're getting burned up by the star, would block quite a bit of light.
Yeah.
If there were a sufficient mass of them.
And so the idea is the blocking of light, the up and down fluctuations could be a debris field. And then the dimming is actually, it consumed a planet in it, so it got brighter because it has all of this extra fuel. And then it used up the fuel, and so it's dimming.
That seems awfully tenuous at the scale of a planet versus a star. Even if Jupiter fell into the sun, Jupiter is an insignificant, paltry mass compared to the sun, and the Earth is a paltry, insignificant mass compared to Jupiter. So even if the entire solar system spiraled into the sun, I don't know that would really do an awful lot.
I didn't do the math.
Okay.
But they did, and they say this is it's the best solution because it explains both the dimming and it explains the unpredictable blocking out.
Did it explain the hyperspace bypass?
Yeah, that doesn't explain the hyperspace bypass or the sign that says "Eat at Joe's" that's circling.
What about the Vogon poetry? Did it explain that?
Nothing explains Vogon poetry.
Leave that the truth.
We are at a little over an hour. Do we want to call that a day?
Do you want to talk about Rogue One first?
Oh. Yeah, fine. Okay, let's talk about Rogue One first. We may not have an awful lot to say, depending on how you felt about the movie.
Yeah.
What did you think of Rogue One?
I thought it was okay. I thought the ending was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
I especially liked... I loved how little they used the Force. I like how, you have in the original trilogy, especially the first of the original trilogy, A New Hope, we see the Force a couple of times. But then the prequels comes and everybody's using the Force for everything all the time, and it's like whoop-de-doo. But it was nice in this that we don't see a Force user basically until Vader shows up, and he uses it very sparingly, which really heightens the actual impact of someone who's never met a Jedi before or a Sith before suddenly seeing a Force user. I also liked the re-spiritualization of the Force, how we have the blind monk guy, and he's going through, and he's got his mantra, and he's able to kind of use that. What I didn't like is that they were taking... They were in a rush to get to the end. In terms of character development, like, I would have liked to see a lot more depth, especially with the lead. I can't even remember her name.
Jin Erso.
Huh?
So you're going for the character.
No, I'm going for the character.
Yes, Jin Erso.
Yeah, you know, Jin Erso, like, she goes from a I don't care about the Empire at all to giving an impassioned speech in a blink of an eye.
Yeah.
And it was...
For no clear reason.
Exactly. There needed to be at least a conversation there.
Yeah.
And then Forrest Whitaker just, like, lets the thing come. It really... There was a lot to work there, and I'm glad that it was a darker tone. I'm glad that, you know, it wasn't flooded with Jedi. But... It's like the writer was like, yeah, we gotta hurry to get to the cool stuff with the ships and the kapows and all of that. I would have liked to see
a lot more.
Are you sure
that was the writer?
Espionage. The producers, Disney.
That sounds more
Disney.
Like it.
Disney. Yeah, you know, I really want to know what was taken out of the movie because, like, you know.
Call the writers, I'm sure they'll tell you.
Yeah, most of the trailer was not in the movie.
Although the Geeks Guys of the Galaxy reviewed it, and this guy's source said that there were reshoots because Disney wasn't happy with ending it, killing everyone, basically. Which is insane, because obviously everyone has to die because they're not in the subsequent movies.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, this was the only clean way to do it. So they reshot it without killing everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And then Disney didn't like that either, and so, you know, so supposedly...
So they don't like Greek tragedies, but they also don't like things that are not Greek tragedies.
Well, I think it was just that I don't know, I have no inside knowledge, but the story supposedly is that the studio weren't happy, the producers, for want of a better term, wanted to be accommodating, so they reshot the things that the studio weren't particularly enthused about, and then the studio said, no, you guys were right in the first place. It seems a little implausible because that's a lot of money to spend, but I want that story to be true very much.
I mean, that makes sense except for the fact, like, you know, we've saw in the preview where the TIE fighter pulls right in front of her, and something happens in that scene.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen. Instead, it's just like pew-pews.
Yeah.
And there's other stuff with Darth Vader and stuff like that.
Wait, did people miss their shots? Is that...
Yeah, you know.
Stormtrooper was driving the ship.
Yeah.
I think all of my frustration with this movie is entirely in the first half.
Yeah.
Because once... It's funny to hear you say they rush to the end. Once we actually get into it, once Rogue One takes its call sign and heads off to go do its stuff. You know, totally sold in, you know, I don't even care where the AT-ATs were hiding. I don't care how they managed to get all over the island and do this stuff. I don't care. That was all fantastic. I loved every second of that. But what drove me absolutely batshit insane was how long it took to get there and how utterly needlessly convoluted it was to get there. If I were to rewrite the first half of the movie, I have a synopsis of this thing. I didn't want to just be, you know, one of these assholes and say, oh, it would be so easy to rewrite the first half of this movie and make it much better, because anyone can say that. So I was like, okay, fine, let's see if I can come up with a way of doing this that's more clean, that gets what needs to be done. Ditch the whole Saw Gerrera subplot. It takes up lots of screen time. It's utterly unnecessary to the story. We don't need to see this. Just get rid of all this. Just pare this away. It could have been that whole first 40 minutes, you could have done it in 20 minutes tops. Mm-hmm. So easily, in a way that gave Jin a much more coherent development. I mean, essentially the way that I would do this is you open the movie much as it currently opens, but instead of having Krennic kill the mom and take the dad and send the daughter off to live with Live with Forrest Whitaker. It's simple. You just have Krennic just takes the dad. Jyn grows up on Jeddah with her mom saying, hey, the Empire took your dad and killed him, so you better keep your head down. Because now she has clear motivations for being apathetic. The dad smuggles the message out to the rebellion through the pilot, much as happens in the movie. But instead, you don't have all this silly machination with Forrest Whitaker and the other part of the rebellion, which I understand what they're going for, but it was just way too complicated and convoluted. You know, and he's concerned that that Krennic will destroy Jeddah, so he encodes it so that only Jyn can decode the message. They go to Jeddah, they witness the destruction of the planet and the death of her mother, which radicalizes her against the Empire. There you go. 20 minutes tops. Absolutely simple. Everyone comes through it with very clear motivations.
Makes a lot more sense.
It's just like, I don't know. I had exactly the same reaction. I didn't think that the speech was actually all that stirring. But it was just like, why is she just turned on a dime from saying to Cassian, you're no better than the Empire, because the rebels basically did just kill her dad, right? And to we have to have hope. We must totally take on these Imperial bad guys who you just killed my father with. It's just like, it's such a weird transition, which I completely forgot about and forgave, you know, once they actually get going and into the movie. But I mean, I'm just in a weird position on Rogue One where I agree with every single criticism that's been made about the movie. I just don't care with regard to the second half, because the second half was so awesome. I even relented, because my thought was, well, the Darth Vader castle thing is kind of, it's kind of unnecessary. You don't really need to see it. But then if you don't have that, you've got to have Vader somewhere in the first half of the movie, because otherwise when he shows up right at the end, it's just like, where'd he come from? They'd get the opposite criticism if he just shows up for that last scene. It's like, well, that's silly. What do you think of Tarkin? Were you sold on Tarkin and Leia?
No.
Okay.
Tarkin was really bad. Leia was not as bad, but you could still tell.
I thought that Tarkin was, now granted, you know, we saw it on a big screen, but I think that when you watch that on a laptop, which is how Sam will probably consume it, it's seamless. For him, the problem with Leia was that she was always she's framed in bright light on the tinted foil. It was so obvious, and I think maybe because, you know, Carrie Fisher had just died, so all of us were more than usually familiar with what Princess Leia looks like. And by the way, we came out of the theater, drove home, and immediately put in A New Hope and watched it, which is exactly the viewing experience that I recommend. But yeah, the Leia one to me was unnecessarily distracting and annoying, because it wasn't necessary, and because the line was so cheesy and awful. What have you brought us? Hope. Fuck you. That was so, it's just like, you know, have we beaten you over the head enough to remember that the name of the next movie is A New Hope?
Yeah,
you know, rebellions are built on hope. What have you brought us? Hope. Are you ready to buy toys for A New Hope now? But yeah, that was an annoyance to me. But Tarkin, I thought, was great, because he was an integral part of the story. It worked for me. That I didn't think it was distracting. There were bits where you could have done it with a hologram instead. But, it was simultaneously, I thought it was well done and just terrifying for the future.
It makes
most
sense.
Most people seem to agree with you. So
yeah, it makes sense to have Tarkin there. You know, and the first time, like, I've seen it done elsewhere and it hasn't been as bad. I remember with the last Iron Man, they did that with Robert Downey Jr. Whenever they did, do you remember?
I do remember that. He had created a device that could help you relive your memories.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the de-aging.
Yeah, and I thought that was okay.
Well, the nice thing is that they actually had photos of him as a young man that they could work from, and they had footage of him as a young man that they could work from, so I'm sure that helped.
You know, it's just one of these things that the closer and closer you get, the more and more it's noticeable. I think eventually, especially if you have the initial actors there, eventually you'll bridge it. And the other issue is that, like, if everyone was like that, if everyone was mocap, then you wouldn't notice. But because you have mocap next to a live person, then it's really, it's really difficult to get that just right.
Yeah, I look forward to motion capture acting myself. That's the only way I see myself getting in a film at all. Yeah. I am just not pretty enough.
There you go. Yeah.
Apparently, Tudyk wore stilts to do the motion capture for what is it? H2SO4? Is that the character's name?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. H2SO4?
Yeah,
really?
Is that
what that is?
It was a joke. He's called K2SO.
Okay, that's good, because I was about to say, wait a minute, that seems like a bad chemical to be named after.
Names in the Star Wars universe are just a pet peeve for me. I just find it so... It just drags me out of it. And most of the names actually in this movie aren't too bad. Like the prequels are just so awful. They're just so terrible with names. And this one, you know, it would not have surprised me if we got a student whose first name was Jin. Right, that would not be a surprise to me. Cassian, well, that's like a real name. That's okay.
Yeah, St. John Cassian, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So the names were less annoying to me in this one.
Yeah.
You know, the original trilogy kind of pushes it as far as it can go. Because I read a bunch of the Expanded Universe books when I was a teenager.
Oh, my gosh.
I was just like, you know, I'm just so...
Just, you have someone mashing the keyboards.
Yeah. Yeah. But I recommend the I liked the movie a lot better than the Red Letter Media guys. But I will recommend her name's Jenny Nicholson, if you search her on YouTube, she does an interesting review. But I think of her because she has a video about how to come up with Star Wars names. But I should also point out that next to Mike from Red Letter Media, she has the best straight man I have ever seen.
They should do.
She is amazing.
They should do like a pair off between her and Red Letter Media and just like go after each other.
I want Mike Stokler, I want Jenny Nicholson, and I want April Ludgate from Parks and Rec to have a snark off.
Yeah.
I think that would be amazing. So.
Can we throw Stephen Colbert in that mix?
Sure.
Yeah, one of my favorite things is watching Stephen Colbert interview Eminem on a live TV station.
Oh, gosh, that was beautiful.
As if he had no idea
that
who
was
Eminem
so
was.
Painful.
It was fantastic.
Oh, that was great.
Isn't that the Ali G shtick? I mean...
Yeah, it was in that vein. But, like, it was on a Michigan...
Michigan station.
Access. He took over a Michigan Access show, and it was 2 hours...
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Yeah.
Was Eminem in on it?
I think so, but...
If he was, he played it really well.
I think he played it... Because, like, how could you not know who... Because it's not like this was one of the early things Stephen Colbert did.
I couldn't pick Eminem out of a lineup. That doesn't surprise me.
Stephen Colbert obviously knew who Eminem was.
Yeah.
But Eminem made it what seemed like he was getting really pissed off.
Hmm. Yeah.
But I think he's just good like that.
Yeah, I think if you've been sufficiently pissed off over your lifetime,
yeah,
as he appears to have been.
It's a natural state for
right,
him.
Right, it's just kind of something you can slide into.
Yeah.
Okay, any other business for the good of the order?
I think that's it.
All right, let's say we had a podcast.
Au revoir.
Au revoir, right. Au revoir, Belgium.